conflicts between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucid dynasty, the Seleucuses and the Antiochuses in the north. And we'll try to clarify some of the details. It can be very confusing. But this is fascinating when you know the history. And this long handout I've given you is essentially the history in detail of the period. I will, as I say, only have time to make allusions to some of the fulfillments as we go through the passage, but you can read, if you wish, a much more extensive historical treatment of it in the handout I've given you. Okay, verse 2. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven. But not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others beside these. Now, the three kings of Persia, it's interesting. It says there will be three more kings of Persia and a fourth. That means four altogether after Cyrus. There'd be five total or so. And he shall be far richer than them all, and he's going to stir up all against the realm of Greece. This fourth king must be Xerxes, actually the husband of Esther. It was in the reign of Xerxes that the Persian Empire tried to make war against Greece and failed miserably. It was in the time of Alexander's father, Philip of Macedon, that Xerxes, husband of Esther, tried to conquer the Greeks and failed and was humiliated and was driven back into Persia. Later, the son of Philip, whose name was Alexander, came and conquered the empire of the Persians and took it from them. But the problem here is that it says there will be three more kings in Persia and then a fourth, and this fourth is clearly Xerxes. The problem is that according to the Ptolemaic records that we alluded to yesterday, there were about nine more kings after Cyrus, nine more Persian kings. Ptolemy, who wrote, of course, in the third century AD, he listed 10 kings total of Persia. This record would suggest a total of five, or maybe six if Darius and Cyrus are not the same person. Now, it's interesting that Josephus lists six kings of Persia in his treatment of the Persian Empire. And Persian and Jewish traditions also make the history of the Persian Empire considerably shorter than Ptolemy does. And we just don't know who to trust. Or I should say, if we were just trusting Josephus or Ptolemy, we wouldn't know who to trust. But you'll remember that the number of years that are given in the prophecy of the 70 weeks in Daniel 9 would suggest that Ptolemy's reckoning was off by about 80 years. That is, he made the Persian Empire's duration about 80 years longer than it really was, if we're to trust the prophecy of Daniel 9. And therefore, if you read commentators on Daniel, chapter 11, verse 2, they will say, well, this isn't quite right. It said there would be three more kings of Persia, but there are really nine. Or there would be four, but there really were nine. But those commentators are going by Ptolemy's reckoning. And Ptolemy may well have been wrong, and probably was. And Xerxes, therefore, may have indeed been the fourth, not the tenth. I'm more inclined to believe the scriptures, since Ptolemy didn't have any documentation and didn't rely on contemporary sources for his information, whereas Daniel was much more contemporary. And Josephus, who gave a list of only six Persian kings, was 100 years earlier than Ptolemy, and therefore and was from a people who had been captive in Persia and may well have had better information. It's hard to say. Anyway, we won't worry about that anymore, because the whole remainder of the Persian period is dispensed with in a single verse. The mighty king who rises in verse 3 is Alexander. He rises up. He takes the Persian Empire. He does according to his will. Within 12 years, he subdued the Persian Empire. He started when he was 20 or 21 years old and finished when he was about 33. And he died then, but only after he'd conquered the world as he knew it. And it says in verse 4, when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven. This has already been seen in Daniel chapter 8, where there was a goat and a ram And the goat was had a notable horn, which is Alexander. That horn was broken. Four horns came up in its place, the four generals. And out of one of those came a little horn, which was Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, this is actually going to be further information on that vision. In fact, maybe that was the vision that Daniel was seeking understanding to. Daniel chapter 8 is where that ram and the he-goat and the little horn are from. This apparently gives further detail on that whole scenario. Okay, now, after verse 4, we've got the kingdom of Alexander divided into four parts. From this point on, we read about the king of the south and the king of the north. It will not always be the same person. The king of the south will not always be the same king of the south, and the king of the north will not be the same. This covers about 150 years of conflicts between the south, which is Egypt, and therefore the king of the south would be a Ptolemy, either 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, or 6. And the king of the north would be Syria, and therefore the king of the north will always be a Seleucus or an Antiochus, 1, 2, 3, or 4. So we've got changes in generations here, but they're not always noted. I will note them for you as we go through. But anyone who's familiar with the history, and you can become so with almost any good study Bible or any secular history on the period, has no difficulty understanding the fulfillment of this. Verse 5, then the king of the south shall become strong, that would be Ptolemy the first in Egypt, as well as one of his princes, that would be Seleucus the first, who was a general under Ptolemy originally, and then broke off and was helped to establish his own kingdom in Syria. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Seleucus, that is, in the north. One of the generals, one of the princes of Ptolemy in the south. At the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. Okay, let's stop there for a minute. The daughter of the king of the south. This is a later king of the south, Ptolemy the second. He gave his daughter, Berenice, to be the wife of Antiochus the second. So this is a couple generations after the previous verse. Antiochus the second married Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy the second. Now this was a political arrangement, and it was done for the purpose of consolidating power and so forth, making a truce between the two. There was a problem arose, however. In order to marry Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy II, Antiochus II, who married her, had to depose his former wife, whose name was Laodice. And he actually spurned her and divorced her and married Berenice. Well, what happened is Laodice got some support, and she murdered her husband, Antiochus II, murdered Berenice, also his wife, and the son from that marriage. And we read of that in the remainder of this verse. She shall not retain the power of her authority. That is, Berenice was murdered by Laodice. And neither he nor his authority shall stand, because he was murdered also, and his son. But she shall be given up, that is, Berenice shall be given up, and those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Actually, her father also died shortly before this. So her father died. She died, her husband died, and her son died. And this is what is spoken of about all these people being given up. Verse 7, however, says, but from a branch of her roots, this was her brother, Ptolemy III, shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. Ptolemy III, the brother of Berenice, attacked Syria to avenge his sister's death. And he killed Laodice, who had killed his sister. And he didn't take the kingdom and keep it. He just plundered it and took stuff back home to Egypt with him. And it says in verse 8, and he shall carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Okay, so that guy is Ptolemy the third. Now we have the son of Laodice, the murderess, Seleucus the second. He's now the king of the north in verse 9. Then the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. That is, he invaded Egypt, probably in response to this previous invasion of Egypt to his land, but he didn't have any power. He didn't conquer. He didn't have much effect. He was later killed in a riding accident, and nothing more is known of him. It says in verse 10, however, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. Now, his sons are Seleucus III and Antiochus III. They were two, their brothers, and they were the sons of Seleucus II. Now, Seleucus III reigned for 2 years and died mysteriously at war in Asia Minor. Antiochus III, his brother, later came to be known as Antiochus the Great, but not Antiochus Epiphanes. We're not there yet. But Antiochus the Great attacked Egypt and was defeated initially at Raphia in 217 BC, and that's what we read of here in verse 10 and following. However, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. This is Antiochus the Third. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out to fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. That is, though the king of the south, the king of the north came down with a great multitude, but he was defeated at Raphia by the Egyptians. Verse 12, when he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. Now, verse 13, for the king of the north will return and muster multitudes greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with great army and much equipment. Now, on the death of Ptolemy the Fourth, who had fought successfully against Antiochus the Third, Antiochus came down and attacked Palestine, which was weakened by the death of its king because Antiochus the Fifth was 6 years old when he took over. And Ptolemy the Fifth was 6 years old when he took over when his father died. Antiochus the Third, or Antiochus the Great, came down and attacked Palestine, and he took Gaza in 201 BC from the Egyptians. Now, verse 14, and in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also certain violent men of your people, meaning Jews, shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. There was a group of Jews that sided with Syria because they wanted to transfer the control of Palestine from Egypt, which had controlled Palestine for 100 years, over to Antiochus. They wanted Antiochus to be the ruler instead of Ptolemy. And they rose up in rebellion. However, the Egyptian armies crushed this rebellion in 200 BC under the Egyptian general Scopas. So it says they will rise up, they'll exalt themselves, but they will fall. This rebellion was crushed by the Egyptian general Scopas. Verses 15 and 16 then, so the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist, but he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one will stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land, meaning Israel, with destruction in his power. This is referring to the fact that Antiochus, who had first been rebuffed at Raphia, actually comes back down, and he defeats Scopas, the Egyptian general, and he brought Palestine under Syrian rule, out from under Egyptian rule. Now, again, I'm giving you only the vaguest details. The more details are in this pamphlet. If we had more time, we could read them or talk about them more in detail. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. This refers to the fact that Antiochus the Third, hoping to gain power over Egypt, gave his daughter Cleopatra to be married to Ptolemy the Fifth. Ptolemy the Fifth was 6 years old when he came to power. I'm not sure how old he was when he married Cleopatra. This is not the more famous Cleopatra of later years. She was, the Cleopatra that everyone thinks of. Was it Mark Antony that she was married to, I think? She was in the first century B.C., just in the early Roman times. But this is another Cleopatra. She was the daughter of Antiochus III. She married Ptolemy V. And the reason that Antiochus gave her in marriage was he hoped that by this he might use her to bring power, his own power over Egypt, However, it didn't work. She stood by her husband rather than by her father, and he didn't gain any advantage by it as he had hoped. So it says, she shall not stand with him or before him, the one who gave her. Now, verse 18, and after this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land and shall stumble and fall and not be found. This is referring to Antiochus the Great, Antiochus the Third. He invaded Greece and Asia Minor, but he was defeated by Romans at the Battle of Magnesia. And the Romans were a rising power at this time. Of course, this was late in the Greek Empire, and the Romans later conquered it. They didn't yet conquer it, but there was the Romans confronted Antiochus at Magnesia and defeated him, drove him back. One thing that happened as a result of it is that his son, Antiochus the Fourth, who was also Antiochus Epiphanes, was given as a hostage to the Romans for 3 years. What happened is the Romans defeated him and forced him to pledge to give back territory and to pay a huge sum of money to the Romans. And he had to give several persons, including his son, as a hostage until he could pay the debt. So Antiochus Epiphanes, as he later was known, Antiochus IV, was a hostage as his father had to go and try to get some money to pay off a war debt. Well, his father, Antiochus III, actually was killed while trying to plunder a temple in the region of Elymais. And a riot ensued, and he was killed there. And that left Seleucus IV, not Antiochus IV, but Seleucus IV, to rule. He didn't last long. He is mentioned in verse 20. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes, because a war debt was left to Seleucus IV by his dead father. So he imposed heavy taxation to try to cover it on the glorious kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. Actually, Seleucus had a prime minister named Heliodorus, whom he assigned to go out and collect taxes, but instead Heliodorus assassinated him. And so Heliodorus took power briefly. However, Antiochus IV, who had been a hostage in Rome, managed to finagle a switch so that another of the descendants of Antiochus III took his place, his own nephew took his place in Rome as a hostage, and Antiochus IV came out of prison, and with the help of the king of Pergamum, managed to get control of the kingdom of Syria, although he was not the rightful heir. He took it from his another nephew who should have gotten it. And so it says of him, and this is Antiochus Epiphanes, we read of in verse 20, perhaps we're not there yet. Yeah, verse 21 is where we are introduced to Antiochus Epiphanes. And in his place shall arise a vile person, that's Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. It was a sneaky way that he got the kingdom. It was not his legal right by royal lineage. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him, probably a flood of armies, and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a great small number of people. Let me just read another verse and then I'll comment on this. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. Now, it talks about him coming in by intrigue and sweeping away the prince of the covenant in verse 22. Scholars are all pretty much in agreement that the prince of the covenant here is the high priest in Jerusalem. The high priest at that time was a man descended from Aaron named Onias the Third. His brother Jason wanted to be high priest and promised Antiochus that he would pay him, that is, Jason would pay Antiochus a huge bribe to displace Onias and put Jason in the high priesthood instead. Antiochus agreed to this. And so money was to be sent to Antiochus in Syria from Jerusalem. And Jason sent the money by the hand of a guy named Menelaus. Well, Menelaus, when he got to Syria to make this pay this bribe, he actually offered a higher bid. He offered more money and promises at Hellenizing the Jewish culture more if Antiochus would make him, Menelaus, high priest instead, which Antiochus did. And in doing so, this caused the priesthood to pass from the Aaronic line to a non-Aaronic priesthood for a while. Jason and Onias, his brother, were both descended from Aaron, but Jason's friend, Menelaus, double-crossed him and paid more and got the priesthood for himself, and Jason was put out now. So Onias and Jason were both put out. And it says in verse 25, "He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. And yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time." Now, the king of the south here is a reference to Ptolemy the VI. And Antiochus Epiphanes heard that Ptolemy was making plans to come back and retake Palestine, take Israel back from Syria. And this made Antiochus angry, and so he went down and made a war against Ptolemy. He defeated him at Memphis in Egypt, not Tennessee. And there, Ptolemy the VI was a nephew of Antiochus, because Antiochus was the son of Cleopatra, the sister of Ptolemy, or something like that, or the other way around. I forget how this goes. Let's see. No, excuse me. Ptolemy was the son of Cleopatra, who was the sister of Antiochus Epiphanes. So Antiochus Epiphanes was the uncle of the Egyptian king. And so he professed friendliness with him after he defeated him. He didn't treat him real badly, but he did divide up Egypt's power between two capitals. He left Ptolemy the VI, his nephew, in charge of a capital at Memphis, and he took that man's brother, another nephew of his, Ptolemy the VIII, as he was called, and made him head of the capital, another capital in Alexandria. So he hoped, by dividing the capital, the land of Egypt, through the sibling rivalry of these two boys, or young men or whatever, to neutralize or paralyze the power of Egypt. And so it was kind of a friendly-looking arrangement, but it was really treachery and connivory. And when it talks about their hearts shall be bent on evil, but they'll speak lies at the same table, it talks about them being at the bargaining table and making plans as if they're good friends, but really their hearts bent on treachery. Verse 28, "While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land." Now, what this is about is, while Antiochus was down in Egypt doing this split of the power of Egypt, a false rumor reached Jerusalem that Antiochus had been killed in battle. When Jason, who had been ousted by Antiochus from the high priesthood and by Menelaus, when Jason heard this false rumor that Antiochus was dead, he forcibly took back the priesthood from Menelaus. Well, when Antiochus saw this, he saw this as an act of treason. So he came in angrily with troops and slew 80,000 Jews and took a lot more into captivity and left a garrison of soldiers in Jerusalem. So Jerusalem came to be more of a police state kind of situation under the oppressors. It got worse after this. In verse 29, "At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south." And that is, again, Antiochus attacks Egypt again, this time in 168 B.C., just a year after the previous time. It says, "But it shall not be like the former or the latter, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation." Now, this is not the same abomination of desolation that's mentioned in chapter 9, because that comes after the Messiah is cut off. In chapter 9, verse 27, there's an abomination of desolation that happens after the Messiah is cut off. This is in the reign of Antiochus. So obviously the term abomination of desolation can be more than one thing. More than one event in history can be such. Let me explain what happened here. Antiochus came down in 168 B.C. against Ptolemy and took Memphis, the capital that was under Ptolemy the VI. He then came against Alexandria, which was under Ptolemy the VIII, because he heard that these two guys were plotting against him. And he would have captured Alexandria successfully in all likelihood, but he was stopped by the Roman fleet. And the commander of the Roman fleet was named Popilius Laenus. And Antiochus Epiphanes had known this man in Rome, because Antiochus had been a hostage in Rome, remember, for years. And he had known this man, and he knew the power of Rome. Although Rome had not yet conquered the world, he was impressed with their power. And Popilius Laenus, this Roman commander of the Roman fleet, said, you are commanded to go back. He didn't want to see Antiochus gain the power over Egypt, because that would make Antiochus more powerful than the Romans wanted him to be. So they commanded him to turn back. And he said, well, give me some time to think about it. And the Roman commander actually drew a circle in the sand around where Antiochus stood and said, well, you can think about it, but don't step out of the circle until you agreed to go back. And so Antiochus, not wishing to engage the hostilities with the Romans, he, in great humiliation, returned. But he was so angry, he vented his fury on the Jews. And he sent 22,000 troops to Jerusalem, slew a bunch of people. He desecrated the temple. That's what's referred to here as the abomination of desolation. He sacrificed a pig on an altar to Zeus in the temple. He banned Jewish worship. People were put to death for circumcising their children or for keeping Jewish festivals or Sabbath or whatever. This became a great time of horror for the Jews, remembered not fondly at all in their history. Now, it says in verse 32, those who do wickedly against the covenant, meaning Jews who defected and who were not righteous, he shall corrupt with flattery. He made promises to the Jews who had defected his side and institute Hellenistic practices. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. This is a reference to the Hasidim, the Jews who remained firm and holy. They died, many of them. They were slaughtered. But some of them not only survived, but rose up against him in what was called the Maccabean Revolt. We won't have time to go into that history again. We've talked about it before. A priest named Mattathias rose up with his sons and actually made war against the Assyrians and actually beat them after a period of years and rededicated the temple. And it says in verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame and by captivity and plundering. So the righteous, before and during the Maccabean revolt, many of them were killed, but they eventually won. They were strong and they did exploits because they knew God. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them by intrigue, and some of those of understanding shall fall. Mattathias did, and many of his sons fell in battle. To refine them, to purge them, and to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. Now, notice the time of the end. This is the time of the end of what? The time of the end of the Greek Empire. And all scholars agree that this is talking about the period of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is not controversial. Now, after verse 36, however, after verse 35, it is controversial. Because verses 36 through 45, the remainder of this chapter, do not resemble very closely the known career of Antiochus Epiphanes. And there have been many theories as to who the king mentioned in verse 36 is. There are some scholars who believe it is Antiochus. And I guess they just figure we don't know enough about the later career of Antiochus to know whether these things in the last 12 verses of the chapter applied to his later career or not. The known history of Antiochus, they do not apply very well, but maybe unknown history of him, they could. And some believe that the chapter continues to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes until the end. Others feel, there are other theories about who it could be. Some feel it might be a reference to the Roman Empire or to Herod. Some people think it's Herod the Great, who is appointed by the Romans, who this applies to. There are some who feel that it applies to the papacy. This would be the kind of reformed view. And there are some who apply it to a future Antichrist. This would be the dispensationalist. The dispensational view is that verses 36 through 45 skip from Antiochus Epiphanes to an Antichrist who has not yet risen, but will in the tribulation period. Now, I suppose any of these views could conceivably be true, since no one knows which view is correct. And the language of verses 36 through 45 is vague enough and difficult enough that one could argue, perhaps without being refuted successfully, for any of the views. I myself have had trouble with the dispensational view of this, even when I was a dispensationalist, because I never could understand what justification one had for saying that verse 35 was about Antiochus Epiphanes 168 years before Christ, and verse 36 in the following is about someone who will arise, over 2,000 years later, without any hint of a change like that. There hasn't been that significant a change between the various kings of the north and south in the earlier narrative. Now, sometimes there's a generation or two gap in the earlier narrative, but not thousands of years of gap, and it would just seem strange. I can't say it's impossible. It just seems strange if, without any notice, the narrative shifts. It passes over the time of the Messiah entirely over the church age, and skips to a person who's called the king, and we're all supposed to know this is about a last day's figure. To me, there's no evidence in the passage for it. I think the only evidence really for it is that it's hard to apply these verses to any other known historical figure. And of course, if you can't find any historical fulfillment, it's easy enough to say, well, that's still future. In my opinion, the best candidate for this king in verses 36 through 45 is probably the Roman Empire, the Roman emperors. Now, I cannot be dogmatic about this, but it strikes me as true for a number of reasons. There is a general similarity that can be pointed to the conquest of the Roman Empire in this passage. It also fits well, in my opinion, with what chapter 12 goes into, and for that reason I'm inclined to apply it to the Roman Empire. I just inform you, some people apply it to Antiochus, some to the Roman Empire, some to Herod, some to the papacy, some to a future Antichrist. No one knows for sure who these verses apply to. I'm going to proceed with the assumption that the Roman Empire is not a bad theory, and is very possibly the best theory fitting into the context. It was shortly after the time of Antiochus, not real shortly afterwards, it was about 100 years after, that the Romans came to absolute power. However, the Romans were already coming to power in the days of Antiochus, as evidenced by the fact that they could command him to leave Alexandria, and he did it. He was influenced by them. Earlier, Antiochus III had been defeated by the Romans at Magnesia, so the Romans were already on the scene and powerful in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. They simply didn't become the world rulers until about 100 years after his time. But in the general time period, the Roman Empire could be the next parties considered, because it was the Romans who were the next to affect Israel's history significantly. Well, let's look on. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. Now, by the way, shall do according to his own will is also said of Alexander in verse 3 of this. It says, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and shall do according to his will. Now, this referred to a shift of powers from the Persian Empire to the Grecian. There were Persian kings, then came a king who did according to his own will, and it shifted from from Persian to Greek power. Now we have another king who comes along and does according to his own will, possibly a shift from the Greek to the Roman. I can't prove this, but there are many things that suggest this to my mind, this being perhaps one of them. This king also does according to his own will. He doesn't follow his predecessors because he's of another nationality. He's not Greek, he's Roman. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, especially those of the Greeks, but speak blasphemies against the God of gods, which the Romans certainly did. The Roman emperors claimed to be God and demanded even that the Jews worship them at later times, and Christians too. And shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. Now, what wrath has been accomplished? Possibly referring back to chapter 9 and verse 27, which was the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, which talks about the consummation of the wrath. It says, on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined. The accomplishment or the consummation of the wrath of God on Jerusalem. Now, see, here also there's an abomination of desolation there too. The Romans accomplished an abomination of desolation, and Antiochus Epiphanes did, which might be a good reason to jump from Antiochus to the Romans, who were sort of the antitype, who did something similar to that. Both were perpetuators of an abomination that made desolate, as we have seen in chapter 9. Well, let's see here. Against the God of gods, and he shall prosper until the wrath, middle of verse 36, has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor desire of women, nor regard any God. Now, desire of women doesn't necessarily mean he wouldn't like women. The desire of women could be a reference to the Messiah. The desire of the Jewish women. They all desired that the Messiah would be born from them. All the Jews looked forward to the coming of a Messiah. It was the hope of Israel and the desire of women. And so he won't honor the God of his fathers, or he won't honor the desire of women. Meaning, it could be a way of saying he won't honor the Messiah. In fact, the Romans crucified the Messiah. Nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above them all. Now, the Romans did have gods, but the emperors placed themselves as the ultimate gods in their domain. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses. In other words, a god of military power. The Romans certainly were that. They worshipped their military might. And a god which his fathers did not know, he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. I think what this means is that earlier generations of Romans had not been so militaristic. They didn't idolize the military as this later generation of Romans would, who conquered the world. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses, including Jerusalem, one of the strongest in the world, with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. It's not all that clear which land he's talking about and so forth, but this could apply to many rulers in different times in history. Verse 40, at the time of the end of what? The time of the end was mentioned in verse 35, but that was the end of Antiochus Epiphanes. Probably the time of the end in this case, in verse 40, is the end of the Roman Empire. Maybe not. Maybe the end of the Jewish world and the fall of Jerusalem. It's not clear at all. Of course, we don't even know who we're talking about here for sure. Therefore, we're not sure what end is in view. But it certainly doesn't have to be the end of the world, any more than the end in verse 35 was the end of the world. Just the end of one rule, one dominion. At the time of the end, the king of the south, presumably Egypt, shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, like with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Well, he did conquer Egypt. The Romans conquered Egypt, I think, in 63 B.C., if I'm not mistaken. He shall also enter the glorious land. Well, Israel came under Roman power, too. And many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. Now, I'm not sure when Edom, Moab, and Ammon were extinct, but I think they became extinct before Roman times. They were extinct in New Testament times. And it may be that these lands escaped it only by ceasing to exist, that they weren't conquered by Rome because they already were extinct. I'm not sure about that. Anyway, it says, but Egypt shall not escape, because Egypt was conquered by Rome. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. So the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. Now, Rome was troubled by news from the east because there was a Jewish war. The Jewish revolt certainly troubled the Romans and caused Rome to be involved in a bloody war for 3.5 years, which ended in the destruction of Jerusalem. That'd be perhaps the news from the east that troubles the Romans. From the north, we know that the Romans eventually Rome fell to the barbarians, the Vandals and the Huns and so forth, who came down from the unconquered regions of the north. And so at different periods in Rome's history, it was troubled by rumors of wars from the east, that'd be from Jerusalem, and later on, even from people like the Turks and so forth, and from the north. These are the directions from which the enemies that eventually conquered Rome came as well. So it's hard to know exactly the fulfillment of this, but it certainly applies reasonably to Rome as well as to any other known case of history. And it says, and he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many, and he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Well, the glorious holy mountain must be Zion. Between the seas is probably between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean. And therefore, he's besieging Jerusalem, it would appear. Seems like that to me. Yet he shall come to his end and no one will help him. Not necessarily at that battle, but later the Roman Empire did fall. This is not the only possible view. Those who apply this to the Antichrist of the future have all kinds of innovative ideas of how this is going to happen. Egypt and the north and the east and so forth. The east, they say, well, maybe the tidings from the east, maybe that refers to the Chinese armies, 200 million Chinese troops marching against the realm of the Antichrist. The north, maybe that's Russia, and so forth. And there's all kinds of guesses about this, and they could be true, but there's simply no way to establish it biblically. What amazes me is how many Bible teachers speak dogmatically about this and say, well, yeah, when the Antichrist is going to be troubled by rumors from the north and from the east, and that's China and Russia and so forth, and as if there's some clear way of determining that this person here in view is a future Antichrist, A, and B, that we could be sure who east and north and who all these people apply to in some future scenario that doesn't even exist yet. Be careful about people who give you too detailed a futuristic scenario from Daniel or Revelation, because even if they're right in saying that it applies to the future, prophecies have not usually been understood very well before their fulfillment. Even Old Testament prophecies were generally not very well understood until they were later fulfilled. But I personally don't think that applying this to a future Antichrist makes as much sense, not to me anyway, as applying it to the Roman Empire. Now, we're going to have to stop here, sadly. We're going to take Daniel chapter 12 by itself in our final session. I was hoping to do it today, but there's some interesting, very peculiar difficulties associated with chapter 12. It has some of the most difficult parts of Daniel in it to interpret. But let me just say this. It begins with these words. At that time, Michael shall stand up. And it says at the end of verse 12, or in the middle of verse 12, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation. And verse 2 says, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. And there are many who feel this is the end of the world, the second coming of Christ. And this terrible time of trouble is a future tribulation. And those who sleep awakening is the resurrection at the last day and so forth. If this is true, notice it says in verse 12, at that time. What time? The time spoken of earlier in chapter 11. So if chapter 12 is talking about the end times before and the end of the world, then that would seem to justify a late fulfillment of the verses at the end of chapter 11. I'll bring this up again when we get in chapter 12. I'm just giving you this as a preview. However, if the person at the end of chapter 11 is Rome, then this time in chapter 12 might better be applied to the great tribulation of which Jesus spoke, which came on the Jews in the Roman siege and the fall of Jerusalem. I'm going to give reasons for believing that chapter 12 was fulfilled in 70 AD, but I'll also tell you, of course, the alternate view that it has yet to be fulfilled in the future. This is the last chapter of Daniel is one of the hardest to determine its meaning. But when you cross-reference Old Testament and New Testament passages with it, I think that 70 AD stands out as the best candidate for its fulfillment. And some of those New Testament passages are pretty clear. Okay? We'll stop right there.